currently, it doesn't make any sense to worry about 2017 because we all have no control over the market.
By almost every measure, America is a better, stronger place than it was when we started.
Well, in 2017, the big political surprise is that Trump isn't as extreme as he appeared in the campaign.
I think everyone's going to be waiting, as I am, to see what Mr. Trump and his administration is able to put together and accomplish.
I want to bring the greatest people into government because we're way behind. We don't make good deals anymore. I say it all the time at speeches. We don't make good deals anymore. We make bad deals.
Yes, our progress has been uneven. The work of democracy has always been hard. It's always been contentious.
Oh, gee, I've never heard that. I've never heard that.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
It's not a bad start to the year. The market's still in positive territory, struggling a little bit this week. But we will have shortly, within a week, a new president. We also have a Fed meeting coming up. It'll be interesting to see. Will they or will they not? And I guess when and how many times? Hi, everyone. Happy New Year. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in hour one, Gary Dorsch will be joining me. Despite all the cross currents in the market, Gary remains favorably on stocks, less so on bonds and gold. You want to hear what he has to say about that. Later on, Frank Holmes will be joining us. We'll be talking about the gold market and the oil markets. And Frank remains positive as well on the equity market this week, despite all these cross currents and several attempts to cross the 20,000 level. Ryan Poplava will also be joining us in hour one as we take a look at what was moving the markets this week. All of that coming up in hour one.
And I'm John Loeffler, and 2016 was a year of surprises. The Dow was up to a record level, the S&P to record, NASDAQ and the Russell 2000. Who would have predicted that at the beginning of the year, not to mention the Brexit vote and the election of Donald Trump as president of the United States? Well, what does all of that mean for 2017? It's time we follow tradition and take the first live show we're doing of the year and look at the consensus forecasts for the year making its way around the markets, as well as people who think outside of the box, the impact of 2016 on 2017, and cautions and other things that are all involved. It's going to be an interesting big picture today, right here on the Financial Sense News Hour. But first, it is indeed 2017, and Ryan Poplava, we're kicking off with not much movement this week in U.S. stocks or bonds, as a matter of fact. I usually ask you what moved the markets this week, but I guess maybe the better question is what caused the financial markets to remain calm throughout the week?
Well, John, as I mentioned, over the past month, U.S. stocks have rallied on really two developments. Growth, which, you know, I've mentioned quite a bit, had started before the election results. We had that growth recession that ceased in the third quarter. And then Trumponomic expectations. Trump has been given the benefit of the doubt by investors that he will help the Republican pass tax reform, deregulate, and implement infrastructure spending. So, you know, Trump repeated in the press conference that he will be the greatest job producer that God ever created. Gotta love the man.
Humble.
Very. Yeah, I mentioned last week we'd have three speeches just to review, but really only Trump's played a big role. And there was Yellen. Obama had the final press conference of his presidency. Some specific areas of the market did well, and some of those, like the autos, did well this week in response to the Detroit Auto Show and some of the strong guidance that was iterated by many of the companies there for the year. And then there was some movement in oil this week based on the latest OPEC meeting last weekend. It sounds like Saudi Arabia, again, I think I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, want to do more as far as the cuts. And that's been putting a little bit of support in oil prices. But there were some articles that came out this week talking about Iraq ramping up exports despite the production cuts. And in my opinion, maybe taking advantage to move some of the reserves given the elevated prices, maybe still adhering to those production cuts. Not likely. You know, most of these countries, they don't really adhere to them You know, there's a lot of cheating that goes on. And that's why OPEC is going to have some sort of compliance meeting. I forget the date, but that will be coming up fairly shortly and talking about ways that they can try to enforce on their different members. So that is a lot of back and forth on oil, both on supply cuts, on cheating, and then how they're going to enforce these cuts that everyone's agreed to. But, you know, the earnings season's basically kicked off this week as well. Rather nice move in Alcoa. In fact, I've been seeing quite a bit of strength in the commodity sector, looking at commodity prices. I think there was some talk about iron in China this week. But the financials were, I think, a fairly moot point on Friday, despite good results from JP Morgan, Bank of America. However, Wells Fargo did miss on both the top and the bottom. They've had a hard time lately. But back to the speeches, John, this week, Obama, Trump, and Yellen. None really moved the needle as far as the market's concerned, but Trump did have quite a few things to say about certain industry groups, and he did have an effect there in healthcare specifically.
Yeah, it's interesting, Ryan, because President-elect Trump didn't really talk too much on some of the issues he has been known for in this Trump rally. There was no real mention, say, for example, of the corporate tax reform, infrastructure spending, or broad deregulation. It's also interesting to watch a lot of his opponents. They're lining up, if you read what they're saying right now, in sort of an obstructionist mode.
Yeah, and there's been some talk about what maybe in the Senate they could do to filibuster some of these tax reform moves that he wants to push through. But yeah, not really. He talked quite a bit about, I guess, a lot of press-related stories, a lot of the what's really popular right now, the talk about Russia, the hacking. And essentially, he also spent the news conference to wrap up his interest in his company. He had a whole bunch of folders laid out, so it was all related to the legal changes that were being made for the companies and all of his ownership there. He said for 8 years that, you know, he was laying the trust of his company and his sons. And I thought it was just kind of funny that he said 8 years, you know, rather confident there about re-election already, 4 years from now. But, you know, really what did move the market was his unprompted discussion about pharma.
I think a lot of industries are going to be coming back. We have to get our drug industry coming back. Our drug industry has been disastrous. They're leaving left and right. They supply our drugs, but they don't make them here, to a large extent. And the other thing we have to do is create new bidding procedures for the drug industry, because they're getting away with murder. Pharma has a lot of lobbies, a lot of lobbyists, and a lot of power. And there's very little bidding on drugs. We're the largest buyer of drugs in the world, and yet we don't bid properly. And we're going to start bidding, and we're going to save billions of dollars over a period of time.
Pharma. I love what he just emphasizes one word. But healthcare and biotech stocks have been doing quite well this year. In fact, if you look at the NASDAQ biotechnology index, I think it's been up almost every day so far this year and leading up to that meeting conference, and had a bit of a correction. You know, obviously, if he's taking aim at biotech companies, drug pricing, and wanting to be more competitive, he says bidding. So I'm guessing he's looking at competitive measures and not really, you know, hard regulations and price ceilings there. But the industry did take a hit and did bounce back a little bit on Thursday, which is nice to see. And it's so far still up overall this year. The last person to be influential in moving the market, I don't know if anyone recalls this, I did talk about it, was Janet Yellen in July of 2015. In her press conference, she talked about biotech being one of two substantially stretched industry groups in regards to valuations. Social networking sites were the other ones that she was referring to. And that pretty much, take a look at the index on a chart, that marked the peak of the NASDAQ biotech index over the past few years. And currently now it's still like 25% off of where it was back then. So it's amazing what little comments like what Trump made focusing on that. And I think Trump also focused on defense. He talked about the F-35 fighter jet, said that they're going to be looking at bringing down costs down there. So defense stocks, also another area, kind of took a jab on the chin by some of Trump's comments.
So Trump moved the markets in defense and pharma, but he didn't seem to knock the expectations most investors have towards tax reform. I mean, it seems he'll have the benefit of the doubt for some time. So, okay, anything else this week our listeners should be aware of? Obviously, we're going to have a presidential inauguration coming up, but there must be other things going on.
Nothing specific, John. I mentioned already, you know, what's going on in oil, I think is key. I think our listeners should really start to follow what's going on in commodities. Commodities have been in a sort of a rally mode for the past few months. Small correction in gold, but overall, you look at coffee, you look at cattle prices, you look at oil, obviously. You know, there's been a lot of talk, and I mentioned it over the last few months from the ECB, from the Fed. They're beginning to talk about inflation. And as I said just now, if Trump and the Republicans really push forward an aggressive fiscal stimulus policy, you're going to see monetary policy response tighten faster. Yellen talked about it. Evans talked about it this week. So, and the other thing, you know, there are unintended consequences to, you know, some of the things that Trump wants to do. And I've talked about that a few weeks ago in December. Right now, not everything is rosy. Some of the things that he wants to do as far as creating those VAT taxes, possibly a value-added tax, he's really trying to create some policies here that really go against globalization and more against nationalism. And that can have unintended consequences to the dollar. And so if the dollar rises, that has some consequences to those exports. It makes our exports more expensive and could hurt exports and what he's trying to do. So I mentioned that before. I think, you know, fiscal policy is just going to be a very big subject for us to discuss going forward. And right now, despite the Trump rally and the kind of expectations towards deregulation, tax reform, not everything is so rosy for the markets, despite much better growth in earnings, much better growth in a few other areas, but mainly the dollar index is elevated. And the dollar index, which began its rally when monetary policy diverged from the U.S. and the rest of the world. Rest of the world was, you know, pedal to the metal, accommodative, adding more. And we were removing ours. We removed QE starting in 2014, and now we're raising rates, and now for almost a calendar year from December to December. So that's going to have that effect on the dollar. Dollar has strengthened. Dollar, you know, a lot of our multinationals could be hurt by that. Emerging markets and very large loans in U.S. dollars can be hurt by that. And we've had some minor rate shock here. Treasury yields have jumped from 1.8% to 2.6, very minor, coming off the bottom, which was, I think, around 1.3 much earlier the year. And my brother just wrote an article to our clients talking about how in the past we've had previous spikes in rates or in the dollar, sometimes together. And what that has done is typically created a financial event if we've seen a substantial jump somewhere around like 15% in yields. So both rates and the dollar are going to be counterbalancing factors to what Trump and Yellen wish to do. The other thing is that Yellen and Evans recently, like I said, they outright have said it many times that they will tighten faster if they see some aggressive stimulus plans. So a lot to talk about in fiscal policy. I like it. And, you know, no more Fed every single week. So it'll definitely be interesting. In fact, Paul Horn, one of our key financial planners here at our firm, wrote a couple of articles this week, and I really recommend any of our listeners going there and taking a look. He's got some tables there comparing what the Republicans want to do and what Trump wants to do. They're not quite aligned. And then, of course, you got to get past and get a lot of votes so we get past some filibuster. So take a look at financialsense.com. It's got some articles there under Paul Horn, and you should see one soon from Chris after our clients get it first.
Yep, and it's going to be an interesting week as it goes, so we'll be back again on Friday to discuss everything. Ryan Poplava, appreciate it. Have a good week.
No problem, John. Take care.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Last week, we saw a lot of carnage in the retail space. Macy's and Kohl's are the two stores in particular. Sears, Target, a number of other brick-and-mortar stores on the radar for seeing massive closings, layoffs being announced. Joining us on the show today is Howard Davidowitz. He is the chairman of the New York City-based retail consulting and investment banking firm, Davidowitz & Associates. And Howard, I want to ask you about what's been going on here, because we've spoken to you a number of times over the past few years on your belief that we are going to see massive store closings. Howard, would you mind telling our audience the big picture as you see it when we consider what's happening in the retail space currently?
First of all, you have to start out on the basis is we have three times more store space per foot, per person, than any other developed country except China. In other words, we have three times more than England, Japan, France, Canada, or anywhere except China. So we're the second most overstored in the world, and most over-mauled, and most over-everything. Combine that with tremendous growth of online spending. This is a toxic combination. In other words, all the explosive growth is in online, and of course we start out with dramatically more foot than we need. Now, 8 out of the 10 largest online retailers are brick-and-mortar stores. And when you look at what's happening with that, it's interesting. You might say, well, that's the answer. No, it's not the answer. If you take Staples, who does over $11 billion online, that's more than 55% of their business, they're in the tank. If you look at Macy's, who's doing more online than any department store, $5 billion, 18% of their business, they're doing terrible. So if you look at who's doing the business online, Gap, I mean, there's a lot of people, Kohl's. I mean, Kohl's is doing 13% of their business online, so they're pouring money into online development, which is understandable because that's where all the growth is, but they still have the overhead of all of these stores. So what do? If they're doing more and more online, but you still have all of these stores and you're doing less in these stores where all of your overhead is, you're screwed. So that's exactly what's going on. Online has not turned out to be the answer. You have to do it.
Well, the market has been struggling trying to cross 20,000. On this Friday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average at 19,867. Will it breach the 20,000 level and head higher, or are we headed for a correction? Joining us on the program is Gary Dorsch. Gary, let's talk about the Dow. You know, if you're a technician, we've had a Dow buy signal with both the industrials and the transports reaching new levels. And last Friday, we came within a point of breaching that 20,000 market, but we've pulled back since then. So what's your take on the market? Do we cross that 20,000 level? That's my first question. The second is, what is it about even numbers on the indexes that make it so difficult?
Well, I do believe we'll eventually breach the 20,000 level, although there could be a short-term pullback simply due to technical considerations. But it's also interesting to note that 1 week from today will be January 20th. Mr. Donald Trump will be inaugurated as the U.S. president. And January 20th of 2016, just 1 year ago, the Dow was falling under 16,000. It hit a low of 15,600. And here we are 1 year later, now talking about 20,000. So that is quite remarkable. And to go from 16,000 to 20,000 in 1 year, that's a 25% increase. And so when you get to a psychological level like 20,000 after a 25% increase, you're going to have to ask yourself whether the market has already discounted a lot of very positive expectations that it has going forward. The P/E ratios based on a 12-month trailing basis for the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ 100 are now approaching 25 times their trailing earnings. That is the highest since the bubble of the high-tech bubble of 1999. The Dow's P/E is at 21 times earnings versus 16 a year ago. So we've had a lot of P/E expansion, and all this is based on, you know, the Trump rally, as I call it, you know, since the November 9th rally began, with the Dow rising 10% here just in 2 months, and a lot of expectations about a lot of good things, which may or may not materialize. And you have to be almost a tax legislation lawyer and an expert in congressional legislation to really figure out just how much will be able to be achieved as far as expectations of cutting corporate tax rates from 35% down to 15%, and how much will be able to be spent on infrastructure, and how much money will come in from overseas to a repatriation holiday, which may actually become mandated, required by law to bring money into this country, in which almost widely expected the S&P 500 companies will use repatriated money to buy back their own shares. And, you know, stock buybacks are also a big reason why we're seeing the stock market where it is today. Besides, the Fed is still moving at a snail's pace and raising interest rates far behind the inflation curve. The Fed should have raised rates several times last year, as they had proposed to do a year ago. Stanley Fischer, the Fed deputy, said the Fed would raise rates four times, and in fact, they played politics. They did not want to raise interest rates ahead of the election and waited until December to make a small quarter point rate hike. They're far behind the curve. I think we're seeing a little bit of consolidation, but I think the market is still acting pretty positive. It had many opportunities to sell off and to see a pullback by now, and we're not seeing it.
It seems to me, Gary, that this year has a lot of positives and almost as many negatives. In other words, for example, let's say the Republicans and Trump lower corporate taxes. We know that that will increase corporate profits. If they lower the tax on repatriation of those trillions of dollars sitting in overseas bank accounts, if that comes here, some of that money will get to work either in stock buybacks, increased dividends, or even investment. A lot of those things are on the positive side. But on the negative side, if the Fed does raise interest rates this year, as they're proposing several times, that raises the cost of capital, raises the cost of credit, but it also strengthens the dollar, given the fact, if you take a look at where we are today on interest rates compared to where we are overseas, I mean, U.S. bond yields look like junk bonds when you compare them overseas. You've got the 10-year treasury at a little under 2.4%, but if I look at the 10-year German bond, it's a little over 0.3%. So a strengthening dollar is not good for corporate profits. It's not good for corporate sales. It makes our exports more expensive. And it also could create problems in the currency markets. So, I mean, when you take those two and weigh the two of them, which one prevails?
Well, that's a very good question. I think the bullish scenario prevails. If they're able to get a tax cut of that magnitude, which may or may not happen, right now the market believes it will happen. But if they can cut corporate taxes by 20% and bring $2 trillion into this country, of which 75% will go into share buybacks or buying out other companies, I think that would be a greater influence than the headwinds, which would be created by higher interest rates and a stronger U.S. dollar. One thing I'm feeling kind of confident on is that we're going to see a widening of the budget deficit, which was already $600 billion for the last fiscal year. And I think if we get this legislation through, we could see $800 billion to $1 trillion budget deficits, which is devastating for the bond market. And the Fed would be obliged to raise rates at a slightly faster rate given the stimulatory effect of fiscal stimulus. So I would expect the 10-year, which is currently at 2.4, to rise to 3% or higher. And some analysts are saying if that happens, that could be the catalyst for a sharp sell-off in the stock market. So that would be the biggest risk if this was to happen, and that would also send the dollar, I think, sharply higher. You'd see the euro go to a dollar or even or below parity against the dollar. You'd see the U.S. dollar go to 120 to 125 yen, and the dollar is very strong against many emerging currencies right now. So that would be the negative. So you have the positives and the negatives, but if all that was to materialize, a massive tax cut would be the dominant influence and would allow the stock market to finally break through the 20,000 level.
Gary, let's talk about the implications of these higher interest rates on other asset classes. As you mentioned, if there's tax cuts and stimulus, that might be enough to offset rising interest rates. But what does rising interest rates and a rising dollar mean for the commodity class? We've got gold in a rally mode since the beginning of the year. And if we look at some of the gold indexes, whether you're looking at GDX or the Philadelphia Gold and Silver Index, some of these indexes are up double digits. A rising dollar and rising interest rates, what would this do to gold and oil?
Well, I think that would be negative for the gold market. You know, gold had gotten as high, almost as high as 1,400 after Brexit, and there was euphoria about news that the Bank of England was going to resume QE and cutting interest rates. That had an influence. But since that level in early July, the gold market had a nasty decline. Massive amount of liquidation out of the gold ETFs and driving it down to 1150. So that's a pretty low price. It's due for a bargain hunting rally. However, in my technical analysis of the gold market, I always show the level of the Fed funds futures market overlaid with the gold market and other interest rate indicators. And you can see the gold market is very much in tune with what's going on with interest rates. And this recent rally has also been partly due to the fact that the yield on the 10-year U.S. note dropped from as high as 2.6 down to 2.35. A quarter point drop helped the gold market rebound. That's how sensitive it is. But if I'm correct, and if the 10-year yield goes to 3% and drives the U.S. dollar higher, knocks the euro lower to a dollar even, then I think the gold market would meet resistance. We're not too far from resistance. I show resistance at 1,210 right now. I think that's a pretty stiff area of resistance. And should the bearish scenario materialize and the Fed does move forward with, I think, at least 3 rate hikes this year, possibly 4, then I think gold will have one more dip down to about 1,100. And that could be a very good long-term buy area, because that would be about the extent of the Fed rate hikes. I think the Fed's going to shock the market. Most of the Fed funds futures traders are predicting the first move will be in June. I think it'll either be at the February 1st or the March 14th meeting will be the first rate hike, and that'll be a shock. And if they do that, that could suggest that we may have 4 rate hikes this year and not 3. The other negative for the bond market, you talked about the German Bund at 35 basis points. We heard Germany's finance minister, Mr. Schäuble, just 2 days ago call on the European Central Bank to begin to taper and withdraw from QE. Inflation is picking up in Germany, both on the producer and consumer prices. And you have the most powerful finance minister in Germany calling now for the ECB to start tapering its QE. So that could come into play sometime later this year. One of the future meetings at the ECB, they may decide to start tapering even as early as a few months from now, although they have announced they're going to pump in 540 billion euros through QE this year. There could be a battle over that, and that could be another major factor which will drive German interest rates higher as well. And I expect the Bank of England will be raising rates this year, given that their inflation rate is going to be 3% or higher due to the massive devaluation of the British pound. So I think several central banks this year are going to surprise the markets by tightening their monetary policies or withdrawing from QE, which is going to be making this a very interesting year, to say the least. But that would not be a good scenario for the gold market. So if 1210 is not the resistance, then I think the maximum this year would be 1250. Before going back down towards 1,100 under that scenario.
Well, that's going to be rather interesting, because the irony of this Fed rate raising cycle, this has been probably one of the most anemic economic recoveries since World War II. And now you have an administration that's coming in and saying, look, we want to get this economy going again with fiscal stimulus. We want to create more jobs, which would only encourage the Fed to start raising interest rates more aggressively. And we all know, Gary, that most recessions have been brought about by Fed tightening. So it's going to be interesting to see if the president-elect and soon-to-be president is at loggerheads with Chairman Yellen, who basically sat on the sidelines for a long period of time and was reluctant to raise rates. when a lot of people argued that rates should have been raised more aggressively and much sooner. Let's talk about some of the other things that are going on in the market. What about oil? I mean, oil has been in that $50 range. It spent most of last year trading between 40 and 50 after reaching the lows in February. Since then, the price of oil has doubled. OPEC has finally come to an agreement on cutting back on production. Where do you see oil going this year?
It is amazing. Just 1 year ago, the price of oil was dropping under $30 a barrel and hit a low of $26.50 on two occasions. And then here we are now, 1 year later, having doubled to $52.40 a barrel for the West Texas NYMEX crude contract. We have a situation now where, now for the first time, OPEC members are going to be cutting production, but they've also gotten agreement from non-OPEC producers as well to cut 600,000 barrels a day while OPEC cuts 1.2 million. The market's still a little bit skeptical about whether there'll be some cheating or not, but my guess is I think they're going to all decide to play fair. And we will see the full cuts of 1.8 million, and that'll pretty much come into play between now and the end of March as Russia has already made a 100,000 barrel a day cut and will cut another 200,000 barrels a day by the end of March. The rise in oil prices has led to an increase in U.S. oil production, the number of rigs operating. We've increased production here by about 400,000 barrels a day from the lows of a few months ago, but won't be enough to offset the cuts by OPEC. And so I predict that the price of oil will find support at $50 a barrel this year and could trade as high as 60. I don't think it'll get much above 60 because U.S. oil production will eventually increase quite substantially, especially with this administration, and help to keep a lid on it around 60. Now, there could be a lot of tension in the Middle East with Iran and this new administration, so there's always the possibility of some geopolitical tension that could lift oil above 60. So I would want to play it from the long side, figuring that the cuts will be enough to get it to 60, cuts in production, and then you always got the possibility of some military adventurism or threats in the Persian Gulf, which could give it an extra $5 boost going forward this year. So that's going to be another very interesting hotspot in the world.
So, Gary, if you had to place a bet now, given what you're seeing in the charts in the various markets, would you be cautious at this time? Or do you see areas that look attractive for investing? Or should one keep one's powder dry and wait for a possible correction?
Well, do not buy bonds. I think they're further to go down. Bonds have lost $4 trillion of value worldwide, and I don't think the downturn is over yet. So if you're a fixed income investor, be a little patient, wait another 4 or 6 months so you could see higher interest rates and lower prices. And, you know, the stock market is basically sort of an anti-bond trade, as apparently a lot of these algorithms are keyed into this reflation trade, and stocks are seen as sort of a hedge against inflation, which we're going to start to see. So I would stay put if you are invested in the stock market. I do expect there could be a pullback of maybe 3% in the short term, only because the volatility reading on the VIX is at an almost historic low of 11.3, lower than 97% of all time since 1970. It's extremely low, a lot of complacency. And also, we are seeing the most narrow trading range for a one-month period in the Dow, I think, in its history. We've been stuck in a 200-point range for a long time. So that may indicate that low volatility readings could lead to some type of pullback or profit-taking, some selling. There's not much room for error right now. The market's anticipated a lot of good news. Now, if that does happen and we see a 3% pullback, I think it would be reversed. We'd go back up and then eventually break through 20,000 on the Dow and rally to the 20,500 to 21,000 area sometime by the first half of this year. If the Fed does finally start raising interest rates as it's supposed to do, 3 or 4 times this year, and bond yields do go higher, then at that point, that will cause some major problems for the stock market, especially from a higher level. And then if that occurs, we get a tighter monetary policy and higher bond yields, then I predict the stock market will top out at 21,000 on the Dow and start dropping right back down to where we are today. So that's sort of the scenario that I see for the first half of this year.
Maybe 2017 is similar to 2016, a first half story and a second half story. Well, listen, Gary, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you do, tell them how they could do so, please.
I do have a website, globalmoneytrends.com. You can go there to take a look at some of the little blogger pieces that I have put up there with some interesting charts on the various markets. Also, I am updating a Twitter page that I just recently started for the first time. I'm a little late in getting into social media, but nonetheless, this year I've launched a Twitter page, and you can follow me at FX, Frank X-Ray, FX for foreign currency, twitter.com, FX Money Trends.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
If you look at the top 10 companies that are ranked by market cap in the world, many of them are tech companies, and a large number of them are also investing heavily in AI, in artificial intelligence. And one of the recent developments we've seen in the field of AI is a topic called deep learning. To discuss this topic with us today, what it is, how it works, who is using it, and why it is so revolutionary, is Nick Hilbeduma. He is an MIT graduate in computer science and engineering, co-founder and chief scientist at Remedy Health, and also the author of Fundamentals of Deep Learning, Designing Next Generation Artificial Intelligence Algorithms. Nick Hill, thank you for coming on the show today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Nikhil, I think one of the most common assumptions that people make when it comes to the topic of AI and just how intelligent machines can get is that computers are only as smart as their programmers, or they can only get as smart as their programming. And it seems that this new development that we see with machine learning, and in particular deep learning, is moving this conversation in a different direction, at least where it's understood that computers are now learning. I want to take that idea on firsthand, because deep learning is a pretty revolutionary field, I would say. It's based on a number of different technological breakthroughs or innovations, which you even discuss in your book, The Fundamentals of Deep Learning. So would you mind telling our audience a little bit about it, and particularly from the standpoint of how it differs from traditional AI or traditional programming as we've practiced in decades prior?
I think one of the really interesting transitions that has happened in the space of AI broadly is this transition from what we call rule-based AI to statistical machine learning that enables artificial intelligence. And if you look at research that's happened in past decades, at my alma mater, MIT, we have several world-class researchers who actually were part of that first movement in artificial intelligence. And the way they approached artificial intelligence back then was by putting together a set of rules that they believed that they could utilize to actually replicate human intelligence. And so you'd have people who are essentially collaborating on this large library of if-then-else rules. And that was a great way of getting applications that seem to do very simplistic tasks. For example, parse and utilize very basic sentences. But the thing that they couldn't handle was the full complexity of human language, the full complexity by which you and I interact with the world. And what became very clearly apparent is that even though one could conceivably describe every single minutia of how we observe the world and potentially encode that into a static set of rules, very likely it would be incredibly difficult, if not near impossible, to actually go through and compile all these rules and actually hard encode them into a program. And so in recent years, we've seen a massive paradigm shift away from this rule-based mechanism into a place called statistical AI. And the basic idea behind statistical AI is to refrain from defining or hard coding all these rules a priori, but instead building very, very general models that describe how to solve problems and then using real world data to fill in the gaps, to find the parameters that actually fit the function that we want to describe and have that learn from the data. And one of the ways in which we can build a lot of these functions is by looking at specific hardware, like the hardware, the wet hardware we have in our brains, and use that particular paradigm to define models that we can then use to train on new data sets. And we've seen this happen time and time again, all the way from companies like Google, who have used these neural models to actually get human level translation from one language to another, all the way to Tesla and Google applying computer vision technologies to enable self-driving cars. And we're still not yet there in terms of replicating human level intelligence, but there's clearly a massive step function that's been unlocked in statistical machine learning technology, specifically in the innovation of the space called deep learning, which we'll talk about in more detail. And that's really enabling a lot of this stuff to happen very quickly.
Well, it's a good start for the year for just a lot of asset classes. Stocks are up, commodities are up, and interest rates are down. Joining us on the program is Frank Holmes from U.S. Global. Frank, I want to go back to 2016 because we had the election of Donald Trump. A lot of people were betting in a certain direction. In fact, the day you and I are talking, Wall Street Journal had an article that George Soros lost $1 billion betting against the markets after Trump got elected. So stocks went up and gold prices went down. So was it the rise in the dollar that brought gold down, in your opinion?
What moved the dollar, and what's important, and that I've commented many times, is what's called real interest rates. And we become so fixated on nominal interest rates, but not what real interest rates are. And real interest rates are, what will the government pay you minus the 30, it comes out every month, the CPI number. So when gold hit 1900 in September of 2011, the 10-year government U.S. bond was minus 3% rate of return, real rates. So it looked like it was paying you something, but after inflation, you're losing money. And then it went to plus 200 basis points. All along, Fed funds were zero. So it's important to recognize what happened was that we had this massive surge in real interest rates this time last year were positive. They went negative. Gold ran up a couple hundred dollars. And then after Trump, the election, all of a sudden we saw real interest rates start to rise again. That made gold go down. And that made the bonds go through this big rally in yields. Now we've had in the past couple of weeks the inverse of that. The 10-year bond was up to 2.65 range, and it fell down to just under 240. And immediately the dollar rolled over, the price of gold surged.
Now, Frank, normally as we get into the fourth quarter, we have a lot of fundamentals that are going for gold. We have the jewelry buying that typically takes place in the third, fourth quarter ahead of the Christmas season. We have the Indian wedding season that takes place. What are those fundamentals telling you now, and will they contribute to the rise in gold?
Well, I think the big part is to appreciate that seasonality like you're mentioning, but there's another seasonality that happens with gold, and usually it peaks with the Chinese New Year. And we're going to go into with the fiery roosters for next year. It starts in February, the end of January, and its color is gold. So we'll see how that unfolds, and most likely in February, March, we'll get a gold correction. It'll rally and then sort of find a bottom beginning in the summer when you have Ramadan. And then it goes to this normal run. And this year we had Ramadan and Brexit happen at the same time, so we had a bigger massive surge. What we're having right now is Chinese Lunar Year coming up, and there's lots of gold consumption of China. What disrupted it last year, going back to the fourth quarter of 2016, was Modi, the Prime Minister of India, compromised the whole financial sector by saying the currency, your 10s and 20s, which is 80% of the paper money out there, had to be turned in for a new currency. And if you couldn't show where it came from, then it lost 40% of its value. Physical gold in India surged, but overall demand from imports coming into the country, that didn't take place because everyone was stranded and struggling, where can they find cash not to lose this dollar value. Car sales fell by 20% in India. India is doing about the same car sales numbers as America. So that was very significant, this whole idea that people pay with cash for cars, they pay for cash for homes. And so I think that that was the factor that delayed a big run of gold in the year end.
So outside these seasonal factors that typically drive the prices of gold up and down, Frank, do you see any major catalyst on the horizon that could really propel gold forward?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is we've got to witness is inflation, you know, and all of Trump's ideas, you know, how inflationary will they be? And if we start getting that rise in inflation faster than rates are going to rise, then we will see gold surge with that.
You know, one thing that I have heard some of the, let's say, Wall Street people talk about is this conflict. Let's say Trump is coming in and he says, look, we're going to use fiscal policy to stimulate the economy and create jobs. So they're talking about spending on infrastructure, spending on defense, tax cuts at the individual and corporate level. So let's say that gets passed, it gets implemented in the economy and inflation starts to heat up. Let's talk about the Federal Reserve's response. Could what the Fed wants to do, and let's say the Fed starts getting aggressive, could they make a policy mistake and counteract much of what's happening on the fiscal front?
Well, you know, they could, but I think the biggest issue we're going to have is regulations. With zero interest rates for basically 8 years, what it does is you can't have what they call price discovery. You really don't know the cost of money. And it's the ultimate of socialism, where they said quantitative easing. You just didn't have a free market, which is always about a price discovery of supply and demand. And that was manipulated. And I think that during that whole process, it helped stimulate economic activity. But we were on steroids and regulations. So any rise in interest rates would be really stifling to economic growth unless there's a fast track to pull back a lot of these regulations. And it starts in the financial sector, the Department of Labor, which is known as Department of Socialism by some economists. And I think that this interpretation of fiduciary rule basically says that performance is not important, just the price. So that would be akin to saying that you can't have a coffee at Starbucks, you have to go to Dunkin' Donut, and you can only buy your clothes at Walmart. The cheapest is the only thing. And so that was very disruptive, and it opened up for the financial sector oodles of potential litigation. So I think if things like that get pushed back, if they streamline getting a mortgage, they streamline getting a car loan, I think that there would be very positive factors, because even Bernanke, when he left the Fed, went to roll over the mortgage, and he was rejected. So it just goes to show how complicated the paperwork has become.
Well, I can't believe what's happened to our industry, and any of our listeners that are applying for a mortgage, my goodness, or refinancing their house, the paperwork you have to sign is almost an inch and a half thick. And all of that is reflecting this growing regulatory environment that we've been in over the last 8 years. I want to move on to the price of oil. It's hard to believe, Frank, that if we take a look at a year ago at this time, we were heading down to $26 a barrel on the price of oil. On the day you and I are doing this interview, oil prices are at $53 a barrel. OPEC seems to have come together finally and realized they have to do some kind of cut in production. What's your view of oil this year? So far, it's been pretty good.
You know, one of the things I've written about, and we've gone back based on regressional studies of looking at global PMI, which is the Purchasing Manufacturers Index, which is a forward-looking index that comes out each month. And there's a survey of all these manufacturers of how, what do they think economic activity will be like, and if they've got a lot of orders to make cars or widgets or whatever it is, then they're going to consume a lot of energy, and they're going to consume a lot of metal manufacturing a product. So the correlation of copper and oil and gas to global PMI is pretty robust. And we started for a couple of years there zigzagging. We'd be up for 2 months, down for a month, up for 3 months. There was never synchronized growth that we experienced prior to 2008. And last year, starting after Brexit, we started seeing global PMI rising. And what's really interesting, the same people that talk negatively about Brexit are the ones that talk negatively about gold and Trump. just something common because the thought process of the Brits getting fed up with civil law and over regulations and pushing out to leave and go and be independent. It's to me fascinating to see. I get those same people that the gold stocks were up at over 100% last year, and that was too much. And then when they corrected, well, it's a bad investment all along, but they still performed spectacular. Well, I think our gold fund was up close to 80% last year. And that far outperformed the S&P 500. But there's this pervasive negativity that's out there. So we must get through that noise. You must close your window to that noise and take a look at global PMI. And it's positive. And it's remained positive. And interesting enough, India's oil consumption last year was plus 11%. So even with all the stuff I talked earlier about Modi redoing the currency, trying to make everything go digital, and that economy disrupting house sales and car sales, their consumption of energy was plus 11%. So China's consumption is picking up, and the Brits, with the currency devaluation, their exports are up. Tourism is up, going and visiting there. So I think there's lots of positive things for energy this year. But the other thing that's important is that we can now export a surplus. So I think that oil runs over $70 a barrel. Gas pops to $4 at MCF. Then you will see extra supply coming on and drilling because we are the leaders in that technology. Do I think it's going to fall back to 28? No, I don't think that's going to happen. I think there's a real change in the world for global growth.
So given the fact that the PMIs are heating up globally, and that obviously creates demand for energy, OPEC's cutting back production. But one of the things that we've seen over the years, Frank, is that the cost of producing shale oil has come down considerably. I remember one time it was thought to be $60, and a lot of companies are making money in the upper 40s and 50s. So will that extra demand sort of keep a cap in a trading range in oil where, let's say, we trade 50 to 60 or 50 to 70?
Well, I think if that's true and we have oil, you know, we can get oil between 50 and 70 and gas at 350 in MCF, then I don't think it's going to hurt global growth. And I think that it would be actually very attractive for global growth because it would take the pressure. Like the big banks right now are blowing out all their energy debt. I was told Bank of America has $6 billion to dump on the market, and that's performing debt. That's not defaulted debt or bad debt. That's well-covered cash flow against that debt. And the regulators have come and said, well, you just can't be in that energy space. So capital now is getting expensive in energy space from what it used to be 200 basis points to borrow. It's now pushing 12%, 8 to 12% cost of capital.
What about the rest of the commodity complex? Let's talk about, like, for ag, for example. The one thing that we know is every year there's more people born globally. We keep adding to global population, which means there's more mouths to feed. What about the ag sector and the rest of the commodity complex going along with what we're seeing right now in the movement in the price of oil and the price of gold?
You know what's America's ingenuity, just as with fracking or Facebook or Apple or whatever you want to think of? The smartphone is only 10 years old. We've made massive strides in agriculture. The yield that you get out of an acre for corn and for wheat, we're just leaders of that technology and being able to actually export that best process, et cetera. So I don't think we can get short-term supply-demand runs, but I don't think you're going to see commodity prices become really, really inflationary, the soft commodities. But there'll be interesting parts we like orange juice. I think orange juice is one of those real specialties that everyone was worried now that it was going to give you diabetes because of the sugar and sucrose, and it could get confusing. So consumption of healthy orange juice has dropped dramatically. So the orange groves, et cetera, they've all shrunk and they've had some diseases, et cetera. So someone's going to come out with some paper that says orange is good for you. And then you can get, you know, a sustainable run for a couple of years, maybe 3 or 4 years, where before the orange groves start to pick up their supply, that we could get a big surge in orange juice.
Now, just changing gears a little bit, talking about the rest of the market, it was really surprising to see the market take off in the way it did after Trump's election. I know U.S. Global manages other kind of funds. You're in the stock market. You're in bonds and things as well. How do you see the market playing out this year? Do you see moderate advances, continuation of this bull market, or could we end up getting surprised as we did in 2016 when nobody was expecting double-digit returns, but that's exactly what happened in the final months of the year?
Yeah, I think, you know, here's the odds. The odds in 100 years of data is when the Republicans have the Senate and Congress and White House, it's bad for stock market in the first 2 years. That's the real mathematical risk we're dealing with. But it could be a big difference, you know, with Trump, because he's, if you read his original book on negotiating, you know, he's rattling the cage of every CEO of line items. So I think he's gone through what's the biggest line items for the government. It's military and it's healthcare. So he's gone after both of those sectors. They have to get their costs under. They have to drop. And I think that things like that actually could be beneficial to the overall economy. So I'm positive. You know, I'm an optimist.
Okay, so if you were to make some bets this year, let's say placing your money, putting it to work, what do you think is going to be the best place to be?
Small cap stocks, small cap to mid cap. You know, I think that they're going to continue to do well, especially with Trump's domestic policies, which is all pro growth in America.
And a lot of that, and especially if a rising dollar, which we know sometimes crimps the profits on the large multinationals that make up the, let's say, the Dow or the S&P. I know that small cap stocks and mid cap stocks were the best performers in the last part of the year. So, Frank, overall, you expect that trend to continue then?
I do, but I think you're going to have that. You know, historically, by the quants, or the University of Chicago, the odds of you doing better in small cap value are significant. And so I think that when you have government policies as a precursor to change, when you have government policies that are pro-domestic spending, then you want to take a look at those companies that can move fastest to respond to that. And it's very difficult for big companies to respond quickly like the smaller companies. And I think that's why the Russell 2000 has been on a tear, far, far better than the S&P 500. And I think that that will continue. They were far underperforming. You get better, more attractive cash flow returns on invested capital. And I think that that's where we're going to see tremendous growth opportunity.
All right. Well, listen, Frank, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, you're a prolific writer, how can they do so, please?
USfunds.com and sign up for Frank Talk or the Investor Alert. We publish every week on a regular basis, and we do what's called a SWOT analysis at USfunds.com of different asset classes. And that SWOT analysis is like the NFL or NBA coaches looking at last week's game, which is strengths and weaknesses, and then looking next week opportunities and threats. And it's always succinct and comprehensive because there's only three sentences for each, so you don't get lost in too many words.
Starting off 2017, coming up next on The Big Picture, what we do at the beginning of the year, every year, is to look at what the consensus is as far as forecasts go for the coming year. And we'll look both from the general consensus and then also from people who tend to think outside of the box. It's the first part of our two-part series that we do every single year, forecasting the year to come. As the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.